Yeah, no, Henry, look, I'm absolutely privileged to have you on The Chronicle Man. I know we tried to do this some time ago, a couple of years ago during the pandemic, but for some reason the time zones were all mixed up and I felt really bad that we just couldn't get that show together. We couldn't meet in person and talk together. But this time, it's the second time, the revenge recording, as they say, you know. So I'm really happy that we can finally meet and talk in virtual space. And that you can come on and talk to our listeners in the Crown of Command and to share your story, mate, and to tell everybody who you are and your place in the hobby. So thanks for coming on.
Oh, well, you're very welcome. I mean, and seriously, I'm delighted. I'm always, you know, you big me up so much online. It's lovely, Josh. But I'm always slightly surprised when people want to interview me, right? And it's something that I've got much, you know, better about dealing with, but I think it comes from kind of imposter syndrome that I suffered with for a long, long time. But I've, for various reasons, I've learned a lot of psychology in the last couple of years. So now it's like, well, I suppose, apart from anything else, I have been around quite a long time. And I suppose I have got a kind of prominence in the hobby, partly because, well, for a number of reasons. I think, back in the day, when I launched my own magazine, you know, back in 2006, you know, that I suppose put me, gave me a kind of prominence that I hadn't had before. Although, to be honest, I suppose I put my head above the parapet. Whoa, this is ancient history for some people. I created my first Battle Games website on the 18th of June, which is Waterloo Day, in 1998, back in the days when I was one of the very first web designers in our part of the UK. And I was saying to clients, I could do a web, because we called them web pages back then, didn't we? I could do a web page for you. And they were saying either, what the hell's a web page? Or why the hell would I ever want a web page? Yeah. So it was like, you know, for quite some time, I was knocking on people's door. And so actually starting my first Battle Games website originally was actually just a result of a self-brainstorm, thinking about what could I do to convince my graphic design clients that I can do websites and that they're a worthwhile thing. And I was like, oh, God. So I was in a reenactment group at the time. And so I did a little web page for what was then the Shire of the Seven Deans. And if people listening might have heard of an organization called the SCA, the Society for Creative Anachronism, which is a big, actually based in America, organization, but has worldwide membership. And we had great fun dressing up in full armor and whacking the hell out of one another on hot days like today. I seem to remember there's nothing quite like the smell of a sweaty gambeson. So I started a website for that, and then I thought, what else can I do? Well, okay, I'm a war gamer, and you know, I back then we had the magazines, we had War Games Illustrated, we had Miniature War Games, we had, for a time as well, you know, Practical War Gamer had died out just a few years before. I think it was just before War Games Soldiers and Strategy came on the scene, but there'd been things like Battle Magazine and stuff. And I thought, well, surely there must be, you know, war gamers out there. I knew a lot of war gamers who were quite tech minded. So I thought, oh, I bet there's some out there. So I created the Battle Games website, which was what we'd now, of course, we'd call it a blog. But back then, no one had heard of the word blog. It was, you know, it was a web page. And to my astonishment, people started emailing me. I mean, email was a pretty rare thing back then anyway, but suddenly, there was a guy in Latvia emailed me, and someone in South America and Portugal and the United States and Australia. Oh, my God, where are these people coming from? And within a matter of weeks, suddenly I had hundreds, which back then was big audience time, hundreds of people logging onto my Battle Games website. And the internet service provider I was using at the time, I won an award for their best performing website. A couple of months running back then, you know, because this was before big businesses had really kind of latched on, you know. So anyone who was attracting, like, you know, a few hundred or even into the low thousands of visits a month was like, whoa, big time. So they got really interested in me, you know, and showcased what I did. And that was great because it also meant that some of my clients started knocking on my door and saying, oh, you said you could do one of those web page things for me, Henry? Oh, I saw you in the, you know, this local thing. How about could you do one for me? So that was how the Battle Games thing started back in 1998. And obviously, so the website's been running now for, oh my God, how many years is that? You know, we're coming up for, wow, coming up for 30 years, aren't we? That's mad. That's mad. And so I kind of felt that, you know, that I'm happy with this. And it gave me a kind of an online presence in the hobby that was really surprising to me, you know. And then obviously what then happened was, gosh, back in the days of Yahoo groups, if people here remember the Yahoo online groups, back in the days when lots of us were still on forums, old-fashioned forums and things, the Yahoo groups, there was a group started called Old School Wargaming. And it turned out there were some guys on there. It started off, didn't have a lot of members, a couple of hundred members, but they all seemed to remember an article I'd written in Miniature Wargames magazine back in, oh my goodness me, 1986, right? All about fictitious wars, what are now called imaginations. And so I joined this group and they were like, wow, you're Henry. Wow, we remember that thing you wrote with the illustrations you did. And I was like, blimey, really? You know, because back in 1986, pre-internet days, you sent an article out. If you were lucky, the editor sent you a check in return, you know. And that was kind of it, you know. We were living in such siloed existences back then, but in comparison, you know. You hoped that someone might have read it. So when I joined this Yahoo group and they were all saying, oh, wow, Henry, you're the Henry that did that thing. And I was like, oh, crikey, okay, right. And there were some discussions in that group. It had been rumbling along for about a year, I suppose. And there was a lot of discussion about the fact that a lovely magazine that had been written, put together, edited by the now sadly late Stuart Asquith, who was, you know, really quite well known in historical wargaming circles. He'd been around for a long time, but he'd had this magazine called Practical Wargamer that was really, had a really lovely, very inclusive approach to the hobby. There was no kind of, oh my God, you know, if I can't put it under the microscope and see the gold braid in the material of that miniature that you're painting, you know, right? Then you're not welcome. Now, his was completely the opposite, you know. I look back now and some of the stuff that they had in his pages was pretty slapdash, to be honest. But it had a really lovely, inclusive feel to the writing, and it covered a broad range of stuff. And also it covered fantasy and sci-fi stuff, in fact. He employed a guy well-known called John Treadaway, who was one of the major organisers of the Salute Show, the South London Warlords, for a long time, and is now the editor of, funnily enough, Miniature Wargames. But so a lot of people missed that magazine, as did I, and there was like, oh, wouldn't it be lovely if only someone picked up that baton and ran with it again, you know, that kind of... Now, the fact is, because of copyright issues and stuff, and the way the magazine had it been owned by a company called Nexus, who literally just had rung Stuart one day and said, Stuart, I'm sorry, there won't be an issue next month. We're closing the magazine down. It's not making enough money for us. So the poor guy was just dumped on his arse, you know. And the magazine just fell into nothing. It just disappeared. Anyway, a lot of these guys on this group say, oh, we really missed that magazine. It had its lovely kind of old school feel and all the rest of it. And I just realized, do you know what? No one's going to do something about this, are they? Unless I do something about this. So I launched my own magazine called Battle Games, and it had a complicated start. There was supposed to be someone else who was going to be helping me to do the magazine, and for all sorts of complex reasons, they had to pull out of the venture literally about a month before the first issue was due to go to press. And I had one of those seminal moments of, okay, do I just look at this and think, well, that was a nice idea, never mind. Or do I say, it, yeah. I'm gonna do it anyway, right?
Yeah.
And I'm a kind of, let's use Battlestar Galactica terminology, I'm a frack it kind of guy, right? Yeah. And I just decided, you know what? This is a once in a lifetime thing, and I will regret it if I don't give it a go. So how can I make this happen? And I literally put out an appeal, said, look, what I need are what we call charter subscribers. Who out there, please, will basically pay their first year's subscription up front to help me to pay the initial print bill to get it off the ground? And I, to my astonishment, 100-odd people said, yeah, I'll do that. And I think it's something like 150 charter subscribers, which is astonishing. And also there were a couple of friends who said, look, Henry, here we go. Look, you know, we've got fairly deep pockets. We'll put it on the credit card for you. Pay us back when you can, which is like, wow. Yeah. So Battle Games was launched. That was in March 2006. It was a bi-monthly magazine. And I was, well, I was chef, top cook and bottle washer. So I was commissioning articles from other people. And one of the lovely things, I managed to bring some old school people in on day one. So Stuart Asquith, who was still alive then, he came in and wrote some articles for me. Charles Stuart Grant, who is still alive with us, Brigadier, ex-Brigadier Charles Grant, he came in and revived his Tabletop Teasers series. Which, if people don't know what Tabletop Teasers are, they're scenarios, basically. So he would set up a scenario. Here's the scenario. Here's the forces at your disposal. Go on, have a go.
Yeah.
And they've been really popular back in Practical Wargamer magazine and previous magazines, actually, Military Modelling, Mechanic magazine, for years and years before. So with those two big heavyweights on board, a load of other people said, oh, yeah, I'll write for you, Henry. So, but it was mad. I mean, it was just me here in the attic, which I think I've told you, but other people might not know, was christened by one of my original Battle Games website visitors. It was christened the Luftwaffe, right?
I love
which
that.
Which I thought, yeah, right. So do I. I thought it's stuck ever since. Yeah. And so basically, Battle Games magazine did all right, you know, for probably about, where was it, 2006 through to 2011. And then, but there was obviously, it's a highly competitive market. And it was just me up here in my attic trying to do everything on my own, or sorting out all the advertising, writing a load of the copy, doing the editing, sorting out the distribution, blah, 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 blah. Mad, really.
Yeah.
Don't know where I found the energy to do it. And so that, it got to about 2011. And basically, so a couple of the other major magazines, were War Games Illustrated magazine, that a lot of people will have heard of, got a huge cash injection when it became partnered with, shall we say, Battlefront Miniatures, who gave it a load of money. And War Games Soldiers and Strategy magazine, that had been Spanish-owned, got taken over by a Dutch company, and they again injected a load of cash into that. And there was little old me. I couldn't even afford to get onto the shelves of the big news agents like W.H. Smith's over here in the UK, because, again, I don't know if people realise, but to get onto the shelves of a big chain news agents, they take like 50% of your cover price, plus they demand that you have to pay a special fee, a special promotional fee. And of course, you wonder what kind of promotion are they actually giving me, other than condescending to actually put me on the shelf, right? So that competition just went sky high, because of course that suddenly looked, all their magazines looked really glossy and glamorous and huge. I think War Games Illustrated suddenly jumped up to like well over 100 pages every month, and there's little old me every other month saying, please, hello. So things got really difficult, and it was going to hit the buffers. And So I was just really honest with my subscribers and said, look, this is the situation. I don't know if I can carry on. And I put my tin hat on and went into the bunker and thought, oh my God, you know, people are going to tear a strip out of me. How wrong I was. The vast majority of my readership were like, oh my God, Henry, this is tragic. What can we do to help? And more importantly, I got messages from all three of War Games Soldiers and Strategy magazine, War Games Illustrated magazine, and Miniature War Games magazines. All their editors got in touch and said, look, Henry, we'll see what we can do to help you out and maybe, you know, give you a job or something. Well, two of those magazines said, look, what we could do is, you know, we don't really want Battle Games magazine, but we'd love to have you as a regular columnist. But of course, the amount of income you get as a regular columnist in a War Games magazine won't pay the mortgage, right?
Yeah.
Whereas the people who owned Miniature War Games at the time said, look, oh, we're quite interested in buying Battle Games off you. And even more extraordinary, said, we'd like to keep you on as the editor as well and doing the layout, because basically we like what you're doing, but we want to support it. But obviously we'll buy the title from you. Don't get excited, folks. It really wasn't a lot of money. We'll buy the title from you and keep you on as editor designer. So basically it was like, oh my God, huge sigh of relief. It was weird because I went from being self-employed to kind of being, I was still technically self-employed, but effectively working for someone else for Atlantic Publications. So that was 2011. Then what happened in 2013 was they said, it's coming up for, I think it was like the 400th issue of Miniature War Games magazine. We love your design work. Would you revamp Miniature War Games to make it look more modern? And I said, yeah, sure, I'd love to. So I did a design proposal and went to see the boss of the publishing house, because they did a number of other magazines as well, model railway magazines, that kind of stuff, garden railways. And the guy said to me, we love your redesign. But more than that, we actually think we'd like you to become the editor of a combined Battle Games with Miniature War Games magazine. And I was like, seriously? And he said, yes. So sadly, they let go the guy who had been the editor of Miniature War Games. Lovely guy called Andrew Hubbock, if he's listening. Hi, Andrew. Hope you're okay. But suddenly my workload went from doing all I'd been doing every other month to a magazine twice the length every month. So it was like, oh my God. But it was okay. And people were, you know, it was well received and sales went, you know, it was great. And then it got to 2015 and the guy who owned Atlantic Publishers suddenly decided, literally overnight, oh, I think I'm going to retire. And so, without telling me, sold the magazine to Warners, a big magazine publishers up in Lincolnshire. So literally, I was driving back from a meeting one day and the phone rang. So I pulled over and, oh, Trevor. Hi, Trevor. Oh, yeah, Henry. Need to let you know, you don't work for me anymore. And I was like, what? What? Sorry, have you fired me? He said, oh, no. You now work for this other guy at Warners. Here's his phone number. Give him a call. He'll fill you in. Bye. It was literally kind of like that. And I was like thunderstruck. Anyway, the guy, it was a really lovely guy. I rang at Warners and we got to have had a meeting. And he essentially said, look, Henry, I come from a motorbike background. I have no clue what it is you do. I know nothing about this wargaming thing. So would you please just carry on doing what you're doing? And here's a 10% pay rise, right? So it was like, that was really weird because he kind of just let me get on with it. And my liaison with Warners, shall we say, was minimal for quite some time. It was like, okay, I'll do whatever. Anyway, that was great. So that was 2015. That was great until about the end of 20, 15 when suddenly he contacted me and said, oh, I've been given a new job, Henry, doing this other thing. You're now, and I won't name any names, but you're now under the purview of this other person. And cut a long story short, Josh, me and this new person didn't get along terribly well because this new person was only interested in numbers. They, again, had no knowledge of the hobby, didn't actually care about the readership, and just wanted to come in and impose their ideas of what the magazine should be like. The fact that I've been a wargamer since 1968, 69, something like that, didn't matter a damn to them, right? Yeah. It was just, I think you should do this because this is what we do with our other caravanning, camping, fly fishing, whatever it is, magazines. So we want you to do that in this magazine to get the numbers up.
Yeah.
I put up with that till something like September of 2016, at which point I said, you know what? Enough. So I handed in my resignation and walked away. And then, of course, thought, oh, my God, what have I done? So I'd gone from, you know, not a massive, but a decent salary every month to zip. So then it was like, oh, God, what shall I do? Then life intervened. My mum died, bless her, and it was all, you know, anyone who's been through a family bereavement and has had to deal with being an executor, that kind of stuff, I don't have to tell you what that could be like. And that kind of took over my life for a bit. So when I re-emerged the other side of that, kind of 2017, 2018, I suppose it was, I was literally like, oh, my God, what am I going to do now? I was desperate for money by that point. In the meantime, I'd been keeping an eye on the birth of this thing called Patreon. And so I just decided to take a punt. It's like, literally, what could I lose? I'll contact the people who used to subscribe to Battle Games and say, hey, I'm going to try and doing this. I've been doing a few magazine articles in the meantime. And to my astonishment, I went from zero to like 100 and something patrons within a week. Yeah. It was amazing and very heartening. So that's how I started Patreon, doing, you know, my Battle Chat podcasts and blog posts and that kind of stuff. And then also at the same time, gosh, back in two concurrent with this, because my the book that a lot of people know me for, the Wargaming Compendium, I'd been approached to do that back in 2008 by Pen and Sword. So when I was editor of Battle Games, I think it was at the Salute show in London, their guy came out and tapped me on the shoulder and said, oh, Henry, we're interested in getting into this wargaming thing, and I think it could be good for us. Would you write a book for us? And I was like, sorry, that's not how things happen. I've spent my whole life wanting to be a writer and thinking I'm going to have to do multiple drafts of manuscript via an agent, sending it off to 50 different publishers, waiting 2 years. And this guy just walked up to me and said, oh, Henry, would you write a book for us? Mad. So I was young, I was gullible, and I said, pretty much, where do I sign? And then, so I, you know, the Wargaming Compendium. Well, so I said, what do you want me to write about? And they said, oh, we'll leave that up to you. Big mistake, right? Saying to a guy like me, it's up to you, because of course, I'm not the, you know, I struggle to have limited goals. Let's put it that way. And so this thing just grew and grew and grew. I mean, it's ended up, even in its edited version, it's 520 pages, I think, the compendium. And but again, to my astonishment, that was published in 2013. So that was in the midst of me having just become editor of Miniature War Games with Battle Games when they combined the two. To my astonishment, wow, it, you know, in its tiny sphere, it became a bestseller. You know, got that coveted little Amazon little orange tag there. And it was just like, I was blown away, and the publishers were blown away and said, right, well, we want you to write another one for us, please. And in fact, the complicating factor there was they were quite clever. They got me to sign three contracts for three different books. Yeah. The first of which was Wargaming Campaigns, yeah, plus a couple of others, which I'll come back to in a minute. But the Wargaming Campaigns thing is that great, that seemed like a logical follow-on because I've done a chapter on campaigns in the compendium. Yeah. And it seemed logical, well, if I'm going to expand on something that was in that, well, campaigns, because Don Featherstone, one of the granddaddies of wargaming, back in the 70s had written a lovely book on wargaming campaigns, and there hadn't really been anything of that style or quality since then. So I thought, oh, yeah, there's a gap there. Plus, people knew me for doing my mad, highly intricate mapping and that kind of stuff. So that seemed like a logical place to go. Well, the first book would take me, 5 years to write? Wargaming Campaigns took me 9 years.
Wow.
Well, it was, so that was commissioned pretty much, you know, 2013, and it didn't come out until last year, 2022, because a number of things had happened in the meantime, which we can gloss over briefly, including prostate cancer and a mental breakdown. Those are probably the two key things that happened. And trust me, that kind of thing takes the wind out of your sails a bit. So work on this vast book kind of got put to one side because, particularly when you're undergoing radiotherapy, your energy levels just go through the floor. It's just, and I couldn't think straight. And, the drugs they put you on, that's what led partly to my kind of mental breakdown. So I'm going to say this out loud right now. I'm a big champion of mental health. I hope I'm living proof. You might not think so, but I hope I'm living proof that you can have a mental breakdown. Doesn't mean you're not normal. It just means that stuff got too much for you, but you can come out the other side.
Yeah.
Some people might dispute that I've come out the other side, but never mind. But anyway, so the book, that ginormous book, came out last year, and that again, it's at 526 pages, so almost exactly the same as the compendium had been. So that you can use them as weights, if you're doing weight training.
Yeah, that kind of thing. I saw the video, mate. I really enjoyed that.
Jolly good, Josh. Yeah, yeah. Do you know, some people took that seriously. Some people thought I was. Some people just don't have an irony gland, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, so, but that again is the edited down version. Yeah. And again, I've been blown away at how that's been received. I mean, the most extraordinary thing, Josh, for not just those books, but also my subsequent books we'll talk about in a second, the way that people ordered them. And when the book has arrived at their home, they've taken a picture of it and posted it on social media.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, wow. I mean, I can't express how moved I am by that and how grateful I am for that. That's just extraordinary. And also, let's be blunt, as a now a self-publishing author, wow, what amazing publicity.
Mm.
Effectively, I've got to confess, free advertising. Every time someone does that, I just come along, click, retweet, thank you very much indeed.
Yeah.
And effectively, it's a form of free advertising for me, which is priceless. I mean, because social media advertising, as you may well know, Josh, can be pretty hit and miss and can be expensive and is at the mercy of algorithms and all that kind of stuff. So when that kind of thing happens, that's just phenomenal.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that book came out last year, very well received. It was kind of after that, earlier this year, in fact, kind of February, March, I had a bit of an epiphany because I got a call from the publishers, Pen and Sword. And they said to me, wow, Henry, we thought you'd like to know that the first print run, 2,000 copies, we've sold out. We've ordered another print run. And I was like, wow, seriously, amazing. And they said, yeah. So, I was doing a quick calculation in my head because the cover price is £40 and the contract said 10% royalties, And it's like, oh, wow. So anytime now, March sometime, I'm due quite a nice check then.
Yeah.
And I said, so I imagine it's going to be about X. And the guy on the other end of the line paused. He said, oh, that's not the number I've got in front of me here, Henry. I said, oh, what is the number you've got in front of you there? And he told me, and it was about half what I was expecting. So I said, can you explain that, please? And after a couple of minutes conversation, he directed me to something like clause 29, subclause D, near the end of the contract, in small print, where it says that, oh, yes, if they sell copies en masse to retailers at greater than a 50% discount, my royalty rate is halved. And guess what? They'd sold a huge number of those copies to people like Amazon and Waterstones and others at 55% discount on the cover price without telling me. Yeah. This is the thing about traditional publishers. Hey, I'm just an author. Why should I be told anything useful, right? Yeah. I should just be happy and honored that they've published my book and that my name's on this book jacket and that they condescend to give me a bit of money as a thank you. Well, I was incandescent. I've been involved with the self-publishing world, doing design work in the self-publishing world and consultancy work in the self-publishing world for a very, very long time. And, of course, I self-published my own magazine, Battle Games, for 5-6 years. And I was like, do you know what? Never again. Yeah. So I set myself, you know, in my anger can be a really good motivator for change, basically.
Yeah, that's true. I believe
so,
that too.
Right. Absolutely. So it was like, right, I'm going to show them something. So that's why I contacted the guys, the team at Wargame Soldier and Strategy magazine, for whom I'd written a series of articles about tactics, tabletop battle tactics, and said, look, you know, would you be okay if the rights reverted to me and I did something with them? And they were, yeah, absolutely, it's fine. You know, we're never going to reprint them. Do what you like with them, basically.
Yeah.
The only thing was that all the maps that had been with the original articles in the magazines had been done by their in-house illustrator and were their copyright. Mm. So to solve that problem, I redid all the maps and everything myself, redid all the diagrams and everything, rejigged the text, made sure, because they'd obviously edited down my text, so I was like, okay, actually there's stuff I wanted to put back in and correct, and brought out that tabletop battle tactics book in, was it March? I think it was end of February, March this year. And let's just say that book has already earned me more money in this period of time than working 9 years on wargaming campaigns.
Wow, really? Yeah, that's incredible, man. That's wonderful. Really, really happy to hear that for you, mate. That's great.
Yeah, thank you, mate. I mean, it's just, it was apart from anything, is it proved to me that, yeah, there is a market for this stuff. Yes, I do have an appeal outside of whatever pen and sword total lack of marketing does. I mean, when you're traditionally published, if you're lucky, they put your book on their website. And they have a little printed catalogue they send out twice a year. And probably in the first year your book is published, you might appear in one or two of them. You know, if you're lucky, you might get in the one that comes out just before Christmas. That's their idea of marketing.
Right.
Right. They've only in the last year or two hired someone who specializes in social media. But that means if you're lucky, if you do a tweet like I do on Twitter, if you're lucky, they might retweet you once or twice.
Right.
So it's like, well, I'm doing all the work anyway, right? So why am I not being paid for it? So that was the lesson that the tabletop battle tactics thing taught me. And so then it was like, wow, okay, that's done all right. What do I do now? And God bless social media. A few months ago, I'm really into wargaming campaigns. You know this, Josh.
Yeah.
And back in the day, I kept really meticulous notebooks about, you know, all the campaign moves, where each unit was on each day and what they were doing and what my thoughts were about what the enemy was up to and stuff. And I dug out some of these notes and just put a couple of pages of them up on Twitter. There was one guy in particular, but a bunch of people said, "Oh wow, you should do a book of this stuff." And I was like, "Really? Seriously? Who? It's that so niche. Who the hell would buy it?" And they were saying, "Oh well, I'd buy it." So it was like, well, again, a bit like with the battle games thing. What the hell? Give it a go.
Yeah.
And so that's why the Martin Start 1744 book came out. I suppose it's about a month ago now, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's like, wow, I can't. It's selling. And again, people were getting their copy, posting it on Twitter. It's like, this is amazing. So now, yeah, there's one contract I can't get out of from the traditional publishing route. I've got to fulfill that. But I've managed to buy myself plenty of time for it because I'm not going to rush into it. But basically, self-publishing is where I'm at now. Yeah. So now it's literally, okay, I've done that one. Oh, now what? Because, you know, that's the thing now. It's like all my income I'm having to generate from outside my own head, you know.
Yeah.
So there you go. So that's kind of the story of all my books and stuff, Josh. And as I warned you before the show, if you press a certain button, I can happily talk for 36 minutes.
Fantastic. I'll let you loose now, Henry. That's wonderful, mate. I told you I can let you off the chain and you can talk longer. I've always, like, you know, like I've enjoyed listening to you, and the way I found out about you was through the View from the Veranda series.
Oh, with Neil Shark. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's how I first found out about you and listened to you and Neil talk. And they're actually my favorite podcasts. I love the Meeples and Miniatures podcast, and I'm really sad that it ended. But, yeah, your, I think, 12th or 13th episode you did with Neil over a great span of time, but sort of followed your story, your personal journey, going through like what you just talked about, but in much more detail.
Yeah.
About what you're going through and your struggles and that kind of stuff. So it was really good to just hear you talk about that and then, you know, talk about many other different things about and different aspects about wargaming with Neil. And, it was wonderful. It was great to – I actually listened to them again, I think, a few years ago and just went back and listened to them. And I just I kept hearing the word Skaven over and over and over again. And you're the main reason why I started collecting Skaven.
Really?
Yeah, it was, mate. Yeah. So, thanks to you and your. Yeah, I think sometimes you talked about Warhammer or your past, spells playing Warhammer with your friend Guy or something like that. And
yeah, that's
right. You always referred to Skaven as one of the main races that you play. So, do you still actually have a lot of those armies or books or things like that you had back in the day?
Well, you know, how far back do you want to go?
Wow, beautiful. 5th edition. Nice.
That's what I started with because
right.
there was a box set, wasn't it? Which I think had, did it have in it Skaven and Empire or something?
That was Bretonians. That particular set had
Bretonians.
It's a lizard.
Oh, the lizard men. That's right. Yeah. I kind of forgot. But at some point, I look back at this. So this would have been, what, 1996, right? Mm-hmm. It says on the copyright 1996.
Yeah.
Because I'd been living up in Southend-on-Sea in Essex, and I moved down to Brighton and Hove in, it was about 1991. Mm-hmm. And I had been doing some kind of the historical wargaming stuff with my friend Guy. And it was kind of the early 90s. I discovered Games Workshop in the Lanes area of Brighton. It's kind of the old, what used to be an old fishing village in the center of Brighton, little Twitten Lanes and that kind of stuff. And there was a games, what was then called, of course, Games Workshop, not Warhammer, called Games Workshop. And they sold all kinds of things as well, not just Warhammer and that sort of thing. They sold, you know, chess sets and all sort of backgammon and other board games, some Dungeons and Dragons, I seem to remember.
Yeah.
It was all before kind of the branding men really kind of took hold and said, enough, this is going to be the pure temple of Games Workshop only, right?
Yeah.
But I was intrigued by this box set that had, you know, two small armies in it and the measuring sticks, those plastic measuring sticks, and some templates and the rule book and, if I recall, the battle book as well. And I was like, wow, that looks really interesting and colourful. And apart from anything else, it also came with the, you might have it in your collection there, Josh, the painting guide, the first little painting guide, like a little magazine-y thing. And I thought, wow, that's really good. And of course, the whole Citadel paint range, as it then was, and Citadel miniatures on the walls, you know, in blisters and what have you. And I thought, well, I've done some Dungeons and Dragons, but Theatre of the Mind D&D, way back when I was at university, so in the early 80s. But this kind of intrigued me. I think I had bought a few, or there had been a game shop when I was at university, and they had some, I think it was Raoul Parther miniatures back then. And I bought a handful. But I'd never really done fantasy miniature gaming. There were a couple of rule sets out there for it, but under the guise probably of wargaming in Middle Earth, something of that nature. But when I saw this Warhammer stuff, I was like kind of blown away. It was like, wow, amazing. And I look back now, all these people I now know extremely well, the Perry twins and Rick Priestley and what have you, with them all in the photographs in these books looking so young. Oh, my God.
It's a bit of a while ago now, isn't it?
Oh, my God. Dave Andrews, Alessio Cavatori, and people like that. It's like, wow, they had hair, you know, that kind of thing. Right. But also the other thing that was really lovely was all the terrain making advice and that kind of stuff. And just the fact that they'd really got their act together in terms of effectively creating a game in a box. So they made no assumptions about how much you might know before you came to the hobby. They didn't make any assumptions. You know, one of the problems with historical wargaming, historically, pardon the pun, has been, you know, if you're interested in World War II history, you can play this game. If you're interested in 18th century history, you can play this game. But that's making a big assumption that people are sitting at home reading, you know, the memoirs of Napoleon or something like that, you know, which is like, no. That's not what most people do. Yes, there is a market of people who do that. And in fact, this weekend just gone, you will have seen on Twitter loads of posts about a big show that happened up in, I think it's Northamptonshire, called the We Have Ways podcast show. There's a couple of famous guys, James Holland, who is a historian, very well-known popular military historian, and Al Murray, who formerly was a comedian, actually, but is actually has a history degree and is a highly knowledgeable guy. And between the two of them, they run this amazing podcast called the We Have Ways, as in We Have Ways of Making You Talk podcast, you know. And they, together with obviously a shed load of help, put together this huge festival that took place over this previous weekend, where a bunch of guys from Two Fat Lardies being a very popular brand of historical wargaming, went along and put on some amazing games for public participation at this show. And it looks, to all intents and purposes, like they had an amazing experience. But of course, what they were able to count on with that is that people who went to that show are history nuts. In particular, they're World War II history nuts, right? Because let's say the tickets weren't cheap, right? And so they would pay probably upwards of £100 to spend the weekend at this place listening to lectures about various aspects of World War II. And people were driving around in tanks and armored personnel carriers, and they had reenactors and stuff. It looks incredible. And in this big tent that apparently was like 100 degrees inside, basically the Two Fat Lardies guys put on a series of games over the 2 or 3 days, I think it was. But as I say, that's Great. That's fantastic. But of course, the assumption there is that people at that show are already interested in military history in one kind or another. Mm. And so would look at a World War II game being played and go, oh, that's interesting. That looks like Normandy, 1944. I wonder what that's all about. Mm. That immediately draws someone in. Yeah. Of course, the big question is for historical wargaming. How do you reach out to people who aren't history nuts? Mm. Who, you know, might watch the occasional war movie on, you know, Netflix or something, but aren't necessarily the kind of people who would spend their pocket money, as it were, on books about the Battle of Waterloo. You know, I was one of the kids who did. I did save up my pocket money because I had got the bug because of my father. But of course, I'm also part of that generation whose fathers fought in the Second World War, yeah. Right? And or you know, we're involved in it in one way or another.
Mm.
So I got my bug, if you like, for history from my dad. Now, of course, that's not so much the case. And there's a lot. Yes, of course, there are veterans of Iraq and Iran and what have you. But the numbers involved are so much smaller. Mm. That's the first thing. You know, whereas the World War II, there was conscription, right? Millions of people went to fight.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's a much, much smaller, and you know, it's a matter of debate how small, too small, tiny. You know, it's a relatively tiny number of people, and of course, the more recent wars that have been fought are more, shall we say, problematic in terms of the public's attitude towards them. And of course, as I know, I'm a supporter of a charity called Combat Stress. Lots of guys coming back with post-traumatic stress disorder, more complex. So this is where, going back to Games Workshop, this was where the genius was of a shop on every high street, right? I can't, you know, they're the most profitable company in the world or something. It's quite extraordinary how they've managed that. Basically, with shops selling toy soldiers.
Yeah, that's right.
That is absolutely phenomenal. And this is why, hats off to them. You know, I've got, like most people who've been involved with, you know, fantasy gaming at some point, we've probably gone, oh God, bloody, the prices are a bit steep, aren't they? And oh, they're a bit exclusive. And now it's all, you know, this is where I have to admit, I've kind of lost interest since it's gone all Age of Sigmar and that kind of stuff. My interest kind of started to wane probably at was it 6th or 7th edition? I can't remember.
Yeah.
Round about whatever edition that is. 6th edition.
Yeah.
I think I bought, because the 7th edition book was hardback, wasn't it? And I think I bought that.
Mm-hmm.
And it, but I think it was after 6th edition, I definitely started to feel like, it's not the kind of fantasy gaming I want to play anymore. But up to that point, certainly I could see, you know, no-brainer as a way, a gateway drug, if you like, of getting people into the hobby of playing with toy soldiers.
Yeah.
And the way that they looked after the customers in the shop.
Mm.
Hey, of course, come in. We've got a club night. Play a game. Come in and learn how to paint your figures.
Yeah.
Just come in off the street. Look, mate, we've got some of our new paints there, the base colours or whatever they were back in the day. There you go. Paints, brushes, a couple of miniatures we've put together. Just have a play. Paint with them.
Yeah.
Wow. Phenomenal. And this is one of the reasons why, of course, comparatively speaking, historical wargaming has suffered, because back in the day, if you wanted historical war games miniatures, it would have been probably a general hobby shop or model shop where they would have probably had model railways and model sailing boats and kits, you know, plastic kits, maybe even some art stuff. And oh, yes, there's a little corner devoted to wargaming. And probably that shop would have been run by a grumpy old bastard in a cardigan.
I know those types. I met them. Yeah.
Grumpy old bastard in a cardigan who looked at you down his nose as if you were some sort of piece of dirt on his shoe. What do you want? right? Hardly encouraging.
Yeah.
And of course, makes you beg the question of, well, why did they bother to stock the stuff if they didn't want to encourage people in to come and buy it?
Yeah.
But their specialty was probably model railways, and they were pretty antisocial and introverted. And, you know, I've learned enough psychology now to know they probably had real problems, you know, that they didn't know how to address, you know, social problems. But anyway, that compare that with a Games Workshop where, oh, hi, you know, let me know if you need anything. Certainly in the better branches where they didn't just hound you to buy something, you know, from the moment you got in the door. But the better branches with the, you know, they'd acknowledge you come in the door. Hi there. Let me know if there's anything you need. Right. Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. So they've acknowledged your existence, you know. And so if you're standing there and you're, right. Is there a particular paint color you're looking for? Can I help you? Or, what army do you tend to collect, you know? And I've got, you know, I've had some laughs over the years with that, where I've been in a Games Workshop store and someone's come up to my show, so what armies do you collect most? Oh, 18th century Prussians and Austrians. How about you? Right?
Yeah.
But no, that's just being me being nasty, really. Yeah, but but I've had many conversations with, because the other thing is, obviously, you look at my age, and I would be twice, three times the age of the average shop assistant in a Games Workshop store. So they're like, what the hell's he doing here? But I actually know an awful lot of my compatriots of my age group who will wander into Warhammer because they want a couple of pots of paint, or they just want to see what painting techniques people are using, or just look at the pretty pictures in the books, you know, or, you know, the astonishing painting skills on display.
Yeah.
And I think that's important. Well, I'm very much a generalist. You know, I play all kinds of stuff. And I think that one of the biggest problems can be if people silo themselves into saying, I'm just a fantasy gamer, or I'm just historicals, and the fantasy games are the work of the devil kind of thing. Which is just like, really? Get over it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, why? We can all learn so much from each other.
Mm.
And certainly when I think of now some of the accounts I follow on social media for people doing painting, for example, I follow easily as many people who are painting fantasy and sci-fi stuff as I do people who are painting historical stuff. And there's some great accounts, people like Troy, Sonic Sledgehammer, as he goes under. Who's got now, I don't know, 10,000-15,000 followers on YouTube. Is mad.
Yeah.
And he paints both historical and fantasy and sci-fi stuff, which is fantastic because it just shows that, mate, we're all just painting toy soldiers, really. And so these techniques, yeah, I don't know many historical wargamers who would go to the length of doing non-metallic metals, for example. Yeah. I think that is something that's very much in the kind of fantasy and sci-fi genre. But, yeah, why not? Basing stuff, terrain making. It's a fantasy tree is pretty much like a historical tree, you know. A fantasy farmhouse is, you know, when I look at the Empire stuff, you know, the Games Workshop have promoted over the years, or the Bretonnian stuff. Yeah, that looks pretty much like medieval / Renaissance Europe, right? So it, you know, there's this cross fertilization that's possible. But anyway, going back to your original question, that was the first Warhammer that I bought when things were painted very bright colors,
right?
And there was another game I've got to mention. Advanced Hero Quest.
I was just about to ask you that, because I thought that was the very first product you ever bought from the Games Workshop.
That was. Now,
you probably still have the box set there.
Well, I don't have the box. Well, the box is somewhere else, but the figures get regular outings. I'm going to dig out some stuff. I don't know if you want to take any screenshot.
Yep.
What have I got here? Hang on a minute.
I know from your recent podcast you've been talking about on Battle Chat you're using for D&D and your D&D sessions.
Yes.
Yeah, which is great to hear. Yeah.
Now, let's have a look. You might recognize. Where's the camera?
Yeah. Aha, yes. I do recognize that one. Yeah, he's the. Is it Heinrich?
Yeah, that was Heinrich, yeah. Absolutely. And, of course...
Aha, there he is, the mighty dwarf.
The little dwarf. The mighty yep. dwarf.
That's right.
And, yep. and of course, if you've got a dwarf, you've got to have...
Have the elf, that's right.
Have the elf as well. And yep. then we've got the wizard.
Great Magnus. That's him. Beautiful.
That's him. So they were the first one. And then, of course, that set came with all these wonderful kind of men-at-arms and things.
Yeah.
With their halberds and bills and, yep. and what have you. What a great... And the swordsmen as well. What a great set that was. And, of course, yep. that segued nicely into Bretonians.
Right, yep.
Back in the day. And who else have I got in here? And now they get mixed and matched. So now I've got... I can't remember who I got him from. Someone off eBay, but these wonderful D&D figures.
Right. Yeah,
he's
yeah.
a lovely dwarf cleric kind right. of fella.
Yeah.
But of course, what you're looking for, since we're talking Skaven,
yes,
you're looking for them.
That's right. The giant Skaven. They're absolutely huge. Those plastic models, aren't they?
They're huge with yeah. their kind of saw-toothed swords yeah, and things.
Yeah.
They were huge. And I got so many of them yeah. That I also mounted some onto square bases.
Oh, nice.
Because that was the other thing. HeroQuest, Advanced HeroQuest, a squares-based game but with round bases. What's that all about, right?
I don't know. And funnily enough, I actually started basing my stuff with square bases. You know, using for fantasy. But then I thought, that looks so much cooler on round bases, but the squares don't allow you to have like the 20 mil squares, but the 25 mil round bases, which is a real shame.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I've got both here.
Yeah,
So when I actually would use them if I'm playing on sort of open ground, sure. non gridded thing. Yeah. But of course, then I don't know who have I got in here. Well, I might be better off just holding up a thing with a. It's Ooh. Got quite a selection of...
Yeah, there is, isn't it? Yeah, nice, mate. All the Skaven in there.
Whole bunch of Skaven. Plague monks. Uh-huh. Gotta love them.
Yep.
And, of course, one of my favourite, the Warp Fire Thrower.
Oh, yes.
And Jezails. What I always loved about the Skaven, of course, is they had some terrific stuff when it worked.
Yeah. And when it didn't work, it had this spectacular... kind of ending, didn't it?
You know? Oh my god, yeah, there's yeah. so many things.
Yeah, that
basically,
fine,
yeah. if it works fine, it, you know, it's deadly, but most of the time, yeah. the likelihood is going to blow the shit out of you.
And it was really funny, I think there's one incident where there's a warp fire thrower, and you probably know the warp fire thrower team, right? And I think I misfired and exploded. And then I thought, okay, well, they've got heavy armor, so that should be okay. But but it's minus one saving throw. Oh, well, they're dead anyway. So why was it? Why do they even write that thing in there? You know, they should just say that everyone's dead. That's it. Remove the model, kind of thing.
I had a brilliant incident with the Doom Wheel, right?
Yeah.
Fabulous thing with the prongs at the front and side.
Yeah.
Sending out bolts of lightning. And when it worked, wow, just like, oh, my God, it could fry an entire regiment of, Empire Halberdiers. But I made a mistake because one game I decided to support my Doom Wheel as it advanced with a unit of Storm Vermin, who, of course, are wearing heavy armor.
Yeah.
So when it came to the lightning will strike the nearest target with the heaviest armor, who did it hit?
Blammo!
So I had this amazing moment where my chum Guy, who was playing Dark Elves at the time, because I hate the Dark Elves. Oh, my God. They wrote the Dark Elves to be almost indestructible, I swear. But anyway, I was really confidently advancing. It's like, right! Lightning bolts from my Doom Wheel. And Guy just sat there very calmly as I was kind of doing the measuring and stuff to his unit of Corsairs or whatever they were. And he very calmly said, Henry, that's not the closest armored unit. And I was like, what? He said, look to your left, and my unit of storm vermin just kind of 9 inches away from the doom wheel. So of course they just got fried.
Yeah.
Fried fur and flesh everywhere. I'm holding up one of my favorite miniatures, actually. Here we go.
Oh, yes, the Death Master.
The unpronounceable. What a fabulous model. Yeah. Absolutely fabulous. It took me ages to work out that that was his tail holding another sword. You know, sometimes you get the bare casting and you're not quite sure what it is you're looking at.
Yeah.
Particularly since back then we had to black undercoat everything, right? And I was like, wow, oh my God. And they're all venom swords as well, of course, poisonous venom swords. That's what a fantastic character here is. Deathmaster Snitch. I've got some others. Some of my other favourite models from back then. Tell me to shut up when you need to, Josh.
No, mate, no, go for it, man. Go for it. Loving it. Yeah, okay.
The rat ogres.
Right. Lovely.
Weren't they fabulous things?
His armpit hair as well. That's nice.
Armpit hair and covered in boils and goodness knows what. And, the plague monk standard bearer, that kind of thing.
Yeah, love it.
Gorgeous. They were just, I think that was the thing, is what, magic banners and what have you. Weren't they just, you know, lovely things? Oh, I don't know. Warlocks, Skaven warlocks.
Oh,
and that
nice.
Kind of stuff.
I like that model. That's great.
Yeah, yeah. There's some lovely models. There's another one in here somewhere, I think, with another thing like him.
Cool.
They're great models. So these models all must, you know, they'd be called Old Hammer now, that's for sure. They're all dating back to 1990-something. I couldn't say exactly what.
1992,
1993, yeah. Sadly, I think actually... Some of the worst sculpts and casting at that time were the Storm Vermin. I don't know if you remember, but they were all too big to rank up together.
Right.
Yep. So it meant you've got this elite unit of Storm Vermin. Actually, it's like they didn't like one another. They didn't want to stick together at all. But, I've got a box loads. But I even love the things like back then they were still plastic. The giant rats and things.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Lovely. Rat swarms.
Yeah. I don't know. What else have I? Oh, God, this is a really old one. This was a really old warlord.
Oh, I love that guy. Yeah. He's cool.
Going way back. So that's one of the really early ones, isn't it?
That's
Who
right.
was the sculptor back then? Was it Jez Griffin or someone?
I was going to say, I think I picked up a publication by Tiger Publication, called Heroes for War Games.
Oh, God, yes, I've got that downstairs.
Down the shelf? Okay. I thought it might be on the shelf next to you, but it's downstairs. But it's got a big catalogue spread of all the original Skaven that Jez Gruen sculpted.
Yeah.
And it is my belief, and I'm not 100% sure, but I think he might have actually created the entire race.
Right.
He created the background. He created, obviously the design of the figures and everything like that, and then worked with other designers to flesh out the race itself. And I think the first time I ever saw them appear in the lore and that kind of thing was the Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay first edition core book.
Oh, right.
And in the back, there was a scenario where you faced the Skaven. And yeah, they're the very early Jez Gruen.
Very early war. They were so much smaller, you know, kind of like you can imagine them sneaking around.
That's right.
These ones, unlike the later Skaven that kind of got more beefed up. And as I say, certainly once we got to these blooming storm vermin that won't rack up together, they're a very different kind of proposition, aren't they?
The main reason was they changed the sculptor. So the Marauder miniature team, Colin Dixon, designed a lot of those models. And, of course, the scale of them were just too big and too chunky.
Lovely
models, but, yeah, they just didn't rank up very nicely.
So there we are. So that's me showing some of my Skaven bona fides.
Wonderful. That's the first time I've ever seen them, mate. So thank you very much for the privilege of seeing those. It's great.
Oh, that's you're welcome. You're very welcome. Yeah. And the thing is, as I say, because I'm now doing – D&D and stuff, they regularly get used. These things don't just sit around doing nothing.
Good to hear.
They're getting used in a kind of D&D context, and of course there is now what am I using, 5th edition D&D, I think it is. The one that's kind of vast. and I couldn't possibly remember everything that's in there nowadays, but there's there's a Skaven kind of conversion that's been done, because of course rat men have always existed in D&D, but the kind of ethos of the Skaven needed to be kind of translated to D&D, and it's really good fun because I get to use these old models that I probably wouldn't get to use much otherwise, because I haven't got a local opponent anymore who's into what we now have to call Old Hammer. But there's a lovely guy who you'll see on Twitter under the handle of Goat Major, at Goat Major. Lovely guy called Simon Tonkis, who is someone I met through historical wargaming kind of connections. And he's a fabulous figure painter as well. But he's really into Old Hammer stuff. But he's really old Hammer. He's going back to like third edition, I think was. Because something else that I've just remembered, that the very first Warhammer I bought, the magic came in a separate box, didn't it? With a load of cards and things.
That's right, So that'll be fourth edition or fifth edition, because fifth edition also had a magic set, which I've seen on your shelf in one of your pictures on Twitter. So you do have the fifth edition magic set. Yeah.
Is it the fifth edition? I can't keep remember what edition is what.
Yeah. I'll tell you, mate. Don't worry.
That's all right, mate. But anyway, so that's kind of my the Skaven stuff that I've still got. And I've got, I'm pointing over there, there's a shelf over there with a couple of those really useful boxes full of more stuff. I've got a load of basic Skaven plastic warriors that I'm still in the process of painting, actually. I don't know if I'll ever get around to finishing them. And, oh, God, CJ. What have I got? Have I got it here? Oh, actually, I've got another box. One of the other boxes here, which has got mostly unpainted stuff. Oh, God, but I will show you this.
Yeah.
Hang on, let's put it over there.
Yeah.
Okay, because this one's heavy. You've got things like the Warpfire Cannon.
Ah, right.
I thought that was a great model.
Yeah.
The Warpfire Cannon.
Ingenious engineering from the Skaven.
Yeah.
It shouldn't blow up, should it? On a misfire roll?
Don't stand in the way. I've also got a siege ram, which I haven't finished painting yet. Because, of course, there's this big life is cheap kind of vibe that the Skaven have. And some other, what's in here? Unpainted. Oh, my God. Look who I've just discovered.
Ah,
do you know who he is?
Pragnar, or whatever it's called.
Yes.
The Shattered Amulet guy. He's like the top dude. Yeah, the end
that's
boss.
That's right.
Guy. Yeah, and the fourth dungeon.
I can't remember his name. What is Yes.
Pragnar, I can't exactly remember.
Something like that.
Things that I can never pronounce.
But there we are. He's actually due for a repaint. Because he got well used in various Hero Quest dungeons and things. And who else have I got? Oh, it's this Throt the Unclean, one of the original castings, with the Man Catcher.
Yep, that's right. So, you get ensnared in that thing, it's going to take your head off, basically.
That's right.
Yep, lovely invention.
We've got another, he's going to be some kind of Grey Seer or something like that, isn't he?
Yep. So he could be like a warlock or something like that, easy. Yeah.
And someone pointing, looking important. He's pointing. He must be in charge of something.
Right, and he's got his little warpfire pistol. Yeah.
That's right, warpfire pistol. That's one thing, actually, I do love about the Skaven is the whole notion of the warp stone.
It's like crack, basically. It's like heroin.
It's crack cocaine, right? And up to a point, the more of it you nibble, the more powerful you become. But then, look out for the consequences.
Yeah.
This is great. I've not been on a podcast before, Josh, where I get to get my toys out in this way.
That's awesome. I'm really happy.
I'm really enjoying that.
It's making me happy, mate. It's good to see.
And also, of course, there have been some lovely publications in recent years, haven't they? One of the things that I'm going to hold up, this Uniforms and Heraldry of the Skaven.
Right.
Have you not seen that?
I've not seen that, because that's sort of like later editions, maybe 8th edition or something like that.
But I wanted to grab it. Neil Hodgson and Robin Cruddas. I don't know who they are. Now, this would have been published I suppose it's a few years ago now, but annoyingly, they make it really hard to find publication dates. 2010.
2010. So, yeah, around that third edition, when the third edition came out. So it's like the big reboot of Warhammer, basically. Yeah.
God, was it third edition? Crikey. I've lost track,
mate. Yeah, eighth edition, mate, 2010.
Eighth edition. Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. Not third edition, no. But it's full of, if you're a Skaven nut, right. Stuff that we love, all the different runes and all the different clans, of course. So you've got Clan Eshin, Clan Pestilens, Clan Molder, Clan Scryer. We've got the Grey Seers.
Yep.
All great reference showing, you know, how to paint things. The Warlord clan, so Clan Moors.
Yeah.
And Clan Falcon, whoever Falcon are, someone just made that
something
up.
Something new.
Yeah, dwells in Fortress Warrens, carved into the searing heart of Fire Mountain. All clan members are branded upon birth, and its warriors dye their fur a bright red. The warriors of Clan Falcon bear blades of shiny black obsidian, mined deep beneath their volcanic lairs. There we go. So lots of background fluff, loads of banner designs and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's Clan Morbidus. This is a nice one. Clan Krizzle. They've made up some new clans, basically.
I think
what
so.
I love about this is someone's gone through the Skaven and done what I do with my imaginations stuff.
Yeah.
They've sat there making shit up, Josh.
Yeah.
And I completely endorse that. Clan Septic. Some of the names are great, aren't they?
Right.
Because I know what it could be like, mate, is that someone comes to the hobby and, you know, might not have the same level of imagination as some other people.
Yeah.
And so to a certain extent, you know, some of us might bemoan the fact, oh, God, people need to be spoon-fed these days. Yeah. But actually, my feeling is if it helps get someone into the hobby quicker and more deeply, where's the harm of it?
Yeah,
you know, absolutely. If someone looks at a book like this, and I mean, this is great, Clan Scurvy. So they're like the Marines, they're the Navy of the Skaven, right?
Right, yeah.
With their mad, ramshackle ships. That's fantastic. And in fact, in the D&D campaign that I'm running at the moment, I decided, do you know what? Clan Scurvy fits the bill perfectly for what I want to do, because there's some guys, you know, they're invading this island I've created, Furchtinsel, right? So the Skaven have tunneled their way in and popped up via the silver mines that are on the island. You know, suddenly the islanders are horrified. They're looking for seams of silver. And suddenly they've come across this glowing green stone that's in the mines as well. You know, what the hell's that?
Yeah,
and before they know it, this has attracted the attention of the Skaven, you know.
Yeah.
And so the Skaven launched this invasion partly via tunnels underneath the sea and up into the island, but also partly they do kind of a D-Day invasion, you know, with Clan Scurvy as the people who help transport the other Skaven to the island.
Yeah.
With, of course, much infighting and argument and disasters.
Absolutely. And assassination, no doubt.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Assassinations, bad-mouthing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So actually having this kind of reference material is really useful, and some of this kind of story stuff behind it. I think this is one of those wonderful things, actually, if I'm going to credit Games Workshop with something. The amount of effort they put into the fluff is extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know, they hire people to write this stuff.
Yeah, well, now, I was going to say, like, Bill King was a massive influence early on during the fourth edition era, in creating a lot of the army books, and that's that canon that sort of carried on all the way through the years through various editions and through books and that kind of thing. So, Yeah, he's been a real pinnacle of forming the Warhammer world in many ways.
Yeah. There's another book I'll hold up here, which is more recent again, I think. Yeah. The Loathsome Ratmen and All Their Vile Kin. I don't know if you've seen this.
No, I haven't.
This is a paperback thing by Wilhelm Leiber, but I don't think that's their real name. By the Altdorf Press, of course it's not. Who's actually written it? Mitchell Scanlon is the actual writer. Mm. And this came out first published in 2004.
Right.
Interestingly. So this is a reprint of something that first came out in 2004. Yes, this was 2020, this reprint.
Mm.
So, and again, it's just loads of background fluff and lore about different aspects of the Skaven. So it turns out I'm more of a Skaven nut than you thought I was.
Yeah. I'm really bringing you out of the closet now, mate. Yeah, that's great.
But yes, it's like, the thing is that I think the Skaven, because there's just such a sense of fun attached to them. You know, I've got Empire as well, I've got Bretonians as well, and obviously both those armies can look stunning on the tabletop, Bretonians with all the heraldry and the Empire with all the armor and bright colors. A little thing, I don't know if you know about me, I like the Empire because many years ago when I was in historical reenactment, I was a Landsknecht.
Yeah, I
was one of those German mercenary soldiers swinging around a great big sword. And so the costume that I wore is direct Empire, right?
Yeah, that's right.
The Empire is a direct copy of that kind of Renaissance era dress.
Yeah.
So, you know, that has its appeal. But, I mean, there's a few funky things. I mean, obviously some of the firepower aspects of the Empire can be quite interesting. And, of course, the maddest thing they ever had was the steam tank. A model which I'm now told is worth quite a lot of money, and I've got one over on my
shelf. I need
shelf.
One of those.
Really? And the Bretonians, you know, they've got their kind of philosophical lore behind it, and obviously the sight of all those knights in their caparisons and stuff can look amazing on the tabletop once you've spent months and months and months painting them.
Yeah.
But I just think that those are two armies that are quite serious, you know what I mean? They're quite... Yeah. You know, you could put them on a historical war game battlefield and they would do perfectly well.
That's right.
So it's the Skaven. And the other army that I've kind of got but haven't invested much time in painting it is the Goblins. You know, with their Doom Divers and mad squigs and that kind of stuff. That's another army that I just think, what a laugh. So what I really ought to be doing is playing games of Skaven versus Goblins, because of course they bump into each other in the tunnels under the mountains. But that would just be utterly random as a game, wouldn't it? It would be just completely random. Two totally mad armies doing mad things, fueled by mad potions. What a laugh!
Yeah, absolutely.
And also they're relatively small. The Goblins, in particular. I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen recent Goblins. Have Goblins grown in the same way as Skaven?
Probably. I think so. Yeah, they're probably exaggerated 32 mil or whatever now. But
like the ones,
I feel the same way because I first started Warhammer with High Elves, which are beautiful models from 4th edition, beautiful, gorgeous Jeskuden designs, and they're gorgeous to paint. They look beautiful on the tabletop, but they're so methodical. There's no kind of, you know, there's no kind of, there's sort of randomness to them. But then when I switched to much later on the Night Goblins later on, and I had just a ball playing them because they'll do all this crazy, wacky stuff. You had a fanatic coming out and swinging their ball and chain, and you'd have coming through into the sky and plunging themselves into the units and killing themselves in the process, and all this wonderful war magic, and the shamans will have their heads will blow off because they're, you know, way too much war power going surging through them. And I just had so much fun. And I'd lose every time, but it wouldn't matter because I just had this enormous amount of fun playing them. And I think they're kind of the same.
And I think this is where You know, the contrast between me and my friend Guy, for example. Guy is a typical Dark Elf player. The Dark Elves are just ruthless, right?
Yeah.
I look at that army and I think, well, it looked amazing, right? And with all riding the Velociraptor things and the Corsairs and their sea green and, you know, it looked amazing. In the same way as many elf armies do. But my feeling about them was, where's the fun?
Yeah.
You know, if I want to play serious war games, I'll go historical, you know? Whereas I play fantasy, and this is obviously a personal opinion because not everyone's like this. Some people, for example, people who are very much into kind of the Lord of the Rings and that kind of stuff, it's a much more serious, almost pseudo-historical kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, what you've got there are armies that look pretty much historically ancient / early medieval. Doing battle with one another with a few orcs and things thrown in, sure. But even the orcs behave in kind of, you could say, all right, they're savages in some way, but they're also, they behave in a kind of pseudo-historical way, in the way you might expect, say, a native army facing a colonial force might behave, you know. Whereas with Warhammer, I've never wanted to take it terribly seriously, right? My primary thing is I want it to be fun. And part of that has also come from, I think, starting with the Advanced Hero Quest, which was these guys going down a dungeon assailed by untold numbers of initially Skaven, right? And what a mad, wacky situation that was.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of it, is that to me, Warhammer's almost like wacky races, if I can put it that way. And I love the fact that, as you described the goblins there, in the same way as you could describe the Skavens, that, well, you know, wow, there's a chance they might tear you to pieces, right?
Yeah, yeah.
There's also a chance that they might utterly implode, right, run away. And it takes a certain kind of player to go, you know what? What the hell? I'm just going to give it a go, right? Yeah. And sometimes it works, and a lot of the time it doesn't, right? And it's the same, because of course it's the same with magic. I think that was one of the things as well that happened when at some point magic, and maybe it was this edition, magic just became more like deploying heavy artillery.
Right?
They changed the magic system, and it became much more like magic became kind of more predictable, but also more vicious, right? And I kind of feel like I want my fantasy gaming, I'd want it to have magic, but I don't want the magic to dominate the game. Because there can be that feeling, can't there, that what was the point of me turning up? I just didn't have enough dispel dice. For whatever reason, because I chose a silly army, I haven't got enough dispel dice, so basically I'm dead the moment I make my first move.
Yeah.
And that to me is like, well, you know, what's the point? Magic to me should be something that's not quite so predictably powerful all the time. It shouldn't feel like, oh my God, this is World War One trench warfare and we're going into no man's land. If we reach the other side, we're lucky. That to me is that's not a game.
Right.
I like to feel it's that balance, isn't it? With all gaming, unless you're doing directly a historical simulation of some kind, that notion of the imponderable, of chance, has to be there in a kind of tangible way. But it's a balancing act, because also you don't want it to feel like it's too random. You want to feel like, actually, if I use good tactics in this situation, I should stand a better than evens chance of winning the game. If If I use my troops badly, if I deploy them badly, you know, okay, that's my own fault. But I like to feel like, do you know what? If I've really thought about this and supported my units as they advance and given covering fire and all that kind of stuff, that should count for something. Mm. Rather than, sorry, mate, you just turned up with the wrong army, blat.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And having just written not so long ago the book about tabletop tactics, I would like to feel that those tactics could apply whether you're playing a fantasy game, a sci-fi game, or a historical game.
Mm.
That basically, if you're using your mobile units correctly, your light troops correctly, you're placing your fire, your long range weapons in the, you choose your position carefully so it covers your units advancing, and so on and so forth. You're supporting your units. That should count for something.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're playing a rule set where you just, oh, yeah, Plague of Doom, blat. Oh, okay, I'll just pack up my figures now then on move two. Right? And if mad things are going to happen, they need to be done with a sense of humor, like we've described, something like, you know, your warp lightning cannons too close to your own heavy units. Or whatever, you know. Your Bretonnian trebuchet, oh, it's way off target today, you know. But I kind of feel like it doesn't matter whether it's historical or fantasy, as I say, or sci-fi indeed, that tactics that are appropriate for the level of force that you've got, if you use those tactics, they should work more often than not.
Yeah.
That's how I feel. Of course, I'm going to get your views on this in a couple of days' time.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, no, I'd love so to talk to more about that. Yeah, no.
So you can riposte to what I'm saying here, but that's kind of how I feel about it. But as I say, certainly back in the early days of playing the Warhammer, what a laugh! And you know, I confess I haven't actually played a game of Warhammer Fantasy Battle now for, oh God, it's probably a couple of years with my godson just before he went off to university.
Right.
But what a laugh. It brought back some memories.
Yeah, that's great, man. That's wonderful. Yeah.
Brought back some memories. And I'd like to be doing some more again. As I say, Simon Tonkis, Goat Major, encouraged me to go out and get a copy of, I think it's third edition rule book.
Right, okay. Yeah.
Which is apparently really old hammer. Yeah. It's for me to have a look at, and that would be quite interesting.
Right, quite interesting. I think those, especially fourth edition, that's the era that I sort of started with, and I think it was always Rick Priestley's approach when creating those rules was that, you know, he wanted you to have fun on a tabletop with the miniatures and have, you know, create your own stories and narrative and, you know, have the magic be wild and crazy and the armies, but also appropriately so that you have fun, you can have a laugh at the end of the day, and it's not too serious, not too dark. You know, it's all very colourful and, you know, and very cartoonish, and that's something that's really appealed to me and have sort of followed me all the way through until I got back into collecting this stuff again. I can see with you, with your Skaven and that kind of thing, it brings an awful lot of joy and happiness just looking at all those bright colors and all the cartoonish characters to the miniatures and everything. And the games reflected that as well. And it sort of just got more and darker, more serious later on. And I think that's where, you know, it sort of lost it for me. But
because I think also this is where, you know, I've always, I can confess, I've only ever played one or two games of 40K.
Right.
Just doesn't appeal to me.
Yeah.
And also the real grim, dark aspects of that universe don't appeal to me.
Yeah.
Each to their own. And I can see, you know, Warhammer 40K is probably, what, the most popular game in the world. Just extraordinary.
Yeah.
But it just doesn't float my boat in the same way. There's something about it that just makes me miserable. I don't know how to describe it. Just makes me miserable. Even the visuals for it make me miserable. Yeah. I can see, again, on Twitter or Blue Sky and all the other blooming social media places, people posting pictures of the most phenomenally painted space marines and stuff, Eldar and what have you.
Yeah.
And that's an aspect, okay, I can appreciate that.
Yeah.
But the game itself doesn't do it for me. Also, because it's, you know, it looks much more like a modern war game, if you like.
Yeah.
The notion of all these closely packed tanks going wheel to wheel, you know, across a 4-foot table is just preposterous to me.
Yeah.
You know, laser weapons technically have infinite range, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, the notion that people are getting toe-to-toe with the las cannons, it's like, really? Seriously? No. One of the characteristics of real warfare, which I know something about, is, and one of the terrifying things, is the notion of the empty battlefield, where a battle's going on, but you really can't see anything. You know, that shot that takes your head off could come from absolutely anywhere. Everything's camouflaged, everything's over the horizon, you know, it's like... And if you, for sci-fi gaming, for me to be, I don't use the word realistic, I use the word plausible, mm-hmm. right? I need to feel there's some of those characteristics about it, that it's actually not just wheel to wheel. But of course, this is the marketing guys, isn't it? This is the, oh, yes, you've got to have 10 Lea Russ, whatever it is, tanks and stuff, and 10 companies of space marines to fit on your 6x4 table. What? No. Whereas with Warhammer Fantasy Battle, actually, a medieval battle was a pretty crowded place. You know, I can go with that. So it doesn't offend my sensibility in that way. Mm. I need to kind of put in a proviso because I've really got into, I've finished reading and listening to now all the novels of a wonderful guy called Joe Abercrombie. Do you know Joe Abercrombie?
I certainly don't know. Yeah.
Right. Well, here's a recommendation.
Yeah.
A British fantasy novelist called Joe Abercrombie, who's written a series of, it must be about a dozen or 15 novels. I've lost track. The first lot are called the First Law series, The Blade Itself. Start with The Blade Itself. Mm. But more importantly, buy the audiobooks. They're narrated by a guy called Stephen Pacey, who I swear is the greatest narrator I've ever heard.
Yeah.
And I've listened to a lot of audiobooks. Yeah. His ability to do different voices is staggering.
Yeah.
And the way he's characterized all these different characters in the Joe Abercrombie novels is nothing short of, frankly, miraculous. Absolutely extraordinary. So there's a recommendation, folks. The First Law series, starting with The Blade Itself by Joe Abercrombie, narrated by Stephen Pacey. Go and have a listen.
Right.
Absolutely incredible. Now that's pretty grim, dark, grisly fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's absolutely gripping stuff. And the important thing, there's a vein of humor that runs through a lot of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the way it's narrated, you will just, I swear, within book one, you were going to fall in love with this series.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely amazing.
Okay, right.
I could relate to that for fantasy, for this particular fantasy series. But but normally I like my stuff to have a touch of light about it somewhere, you know?
Yeah. Yeah,
and I think that's why the 40K universe just doesn't do it for me. It might appeal to kind of depressed teenagers or something. But...
Yeah, well, that was the beauty about the 90s because everything was played on green tables and it had golden bases. And, you know, once I started getting back into it, you know, about 5 years ago, just painting those bases green, you know, just... Those glorious colours of yellow and reds, they just, you know, just...
I know, just...
Beautiful, isn't it?
Full colour spread on this is the battle book. Where, and the way that you painted, you did your bases back then, so you'd get your base and you'd sprinkle a bit of sand on top, let it dry, the whole thing goblin green.
That's it.
And then was it a bit of sunburst yellow? You just dry brush the top of the gravel.
Yeah.
Job done.
That's it, mate. It's just... You know, and look how vibrant, look how beautiful those armies look on the tabletop. I mean,
they really do. And the thing, but you know, it actually looks really consistent because the goblin green matches the colour of the mat. Now, I'm really lucky because those original Games Workshop mats are now like gold dust. Mm. And I've got three of them, which, you know, is a real bit. And I use them all the time for my historical gaming as well because they actually look like grassland.
They've got
a really nice texture to. But I mean, things like, oh, here we go. Here's the Empire Army.
Beautiful.
The colours are absolutely outrageous, aren't they? They're fabulous.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah, it's one of the best painted armies I've ever seen in like terms of fantasy historical. It's one of the greatest examples of miniature painting, I think. The Empire.
Yeah.
Just beautiful.
Yeah, and that steam tank is just phenomenal, isn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah.
Absolutely phenomenal. I mean, for your listeners who can't see what I'm holding up, I'm referring to the battle book that was produced in, when was this? 1996. Fabulous. Another great book that I wanted to point out was called The General's Compendium?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I know you mentioned it a few times in your podcast. I think that's
Which is full of loads of ideas for scenarios and terrain making and painting and all kinds.
Yeah.
Now, that was put together by the GW team over in the States. Rather than the UK thing. But it's a beautiful thing, which I recommend to historical gamers, let alone fantasy gamers or Warhammer gamers.
Yeah.
So there we go. So I don't know. What else do you want to ask me?
Well, as you've confessed to be a Skaven nut, I thought I'd give you a quick quiz, mate, and see how pulled you up on the Skaven. So I've presented a few questions here for you, Henry. So
Listeners, he's got like 20 pages of questions there.
Here we go. It's a wrong.
I'm going to fail this test. Go on.
So how many Skaven do you require to push the Screaming Bell? If you know the Screaming Bell, you remember that contraption?
Oh, my God, yes. Yeah. Now, the Screaming Bell. Wasn't that 16 or something?
16? Very close. 10. You'd only need a 10, mate.
But 10? 18
is the preferred number.
18 was the preferred number?
Yeah, because if they died, you still had enough to push it. Keep pushing it till you get to the enemy, and it starts ringing the bell. It probably kills more Skaven than the actual enemy by the time it gets there. But
actually, you're probably right because they did ranks of five, didn't they? So
Now, as you mentioned just before we did the interview, you'd actually go back and listen to one of my podcasts talking to the creator of the fourth edition army book for the Skaven. So this should be a really easy question. So who wrote the Skaven armies book? You just listened to the podcast, you said.
I didn't. I was going to listen to it, but I didn't have a chance to listen to it.
If you can cheat.
I could tell you, I could probably I could cheat. And which book was this? Fourth edition?
No, it's not. That's a sixth edition. But maybe it might be the same writer. I don't know. Because he was still working at Games Workshop at the time. But he looked like a Skaven.
Oh, my God.
He looked like a Skaven.
So was it Alessio Cavatori?
It wasn't Alessio Cavatori. It was Andy Chambers.
Oh, no! I should have known that. Oh, I'm doing terribly, folks. I knew I would.
If you listen to that podcast, I did the interview with Andy. He talks all about how he created the book and, you know, the reasons why he created certain characters and regiments in the Skaven army book, which is really
I definitely have to listen to it now, wasn't I? Yeah. Out of embarrassment, apart from
No. It was a good chat with Andy. He's a great bloke. Now, what colour is Ikkit Claw's fur? Ikkit Claw is one of the characters for the Skaven, and he was a magic user, and mechanical claw.
Ikkit. Now, didn't he have white fur?
Very good. Very good, Henry. You got 1 point, mate. One out of three.
Thanks,
mate. Well done. What is the result for the Screaming Bell when you roll 18 plus on the chart? So you got to roll either 1d6 or 2d6, and each time you ring the bell, you got to roll an extra dice each turn, and it sort of accumulates from there. And the higher the score, the more powerful it gets. But if you roll 18 or more,
doesn't it shatter and kill all its crew as well?
Exactly, which I'm sure you've experienced in your time playing Skaven many a time.
Yes, mate.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, and who wrote the stories contained within the Skaven book? Now, there's a storyteller, a lore master, who created a lot of the stories and background for the Skaven. I sort of hinted. I hinted his name earlier in our conversation.
I can't. No, I don't know that off the top of my head.
Bill King, mate.
Oh, right. Okay.
He wrote a series of books with Gotrek and Felix, and one was called The Skaven Slayer.
Oh, God, yes.
Get the audiobook, mate, because it's absolutely hilarious to listen to.
Okay. Because I've seen that advertised somewhere.
Right.
I don't know. No. Anyway, go on. So it's a Black Library thing.
Might be a Black Library thing. Otherwise, I'll get your link and you can listen to it.
Right? Cool. Thank you, mate.
And, okay, last one. Who drives the Doom Wheel? Who's the driver?
Warlock engineer, isn't he?
Very good. Perfect. Okay, wonderful. So 2 out of 6. Not bad, Henry. Not bad.
I thought I was 3. I got 3 out of 6 there. I got 3.
I'll give you 3. Okay, no, that's all right. Okay.
50% hit rate, that'll do. After this length of time, I'll take that.
Not too bad at all, mate. So I really, really enjoyed chatting with you today, Henry. Like I said, it's been in the making, in the planning for a couple of years now. I really enjoyed listening to you and Neil Shook talking about on the Veranda podcast when I first discovered you and following your whole journey. And now, of course, I'm a patron on your Patreon.
You are. Bless your heart. Thank you, Gav.
And, mate, you've entertained me now for, I don't know, how many hundreds of hours of your podcast on Battle Chat. And I think anybody should go and check it out because it's now available on most podcasting platforms. Now people can access that and listen to
Certainly on Spotify and stuff, yeah.
Spotify, definitely for sure. And they should come and support you on Patreon because there's a lot of other bonus content on there that you can listen to and be entertained for many, many hours. Of course, I look forward to the flip side of this and coming on Battle Chat to talk to you more about Kira Hammer and Games Workshop and the Red Period and everything. And
brilliant.
Look forward to that, mate. So enjoy the rest of your day and thanks very much again for your time.
Thank you very much indeed, Josh. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Okay, Henry. Thanks, mate. Take care.